Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live, and I have a very interesting show today with author George Stimson. I think unless you've been on another planet living under a rock, you have awareness of the Tate LaBianca murders, and probably even if you're younger, a cursory knowledge of the narrative that the prosecutor put forth, which was the helter-skelter narrative, that based on the Bible and the Beatles music, Manson ordered these murders. Probably not one of the more well-known Beatles songs, but Vincent Bugliosi put forth this theory that this piece of music, the Beatles here, that Manson, based on this, his interpretation of the lyrics and as well as Revelation, wanted to start a race war, and then him and his friends would come out of the bottomless pit. But that narrative has not been challenged very much. Manson's defense seemed pretty weak in the trial in challenging that. And we'll be back in about 20 seconds with George Stimson, who has done some really exhaustive work. I mean, just a Herculean effort in spending a lot of time on both coasts and interviewing Manson extensively. And we're going to look at another view of this story. And so if you have any interest in this case at all, this will prove to be, I think, one of the more fascinating half hours we've spent here on Richard Rossi Live. We'll be back with author George Stimson. Welcome back. How are you, George?
I'm doing fine, Richard. It's good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. Congratulations on this work. And if you're listening, this book, Goodbye Helter Skelter, you can get it on Amazon, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I got mine on Amazon or at the website goodbyehelterskelter.com. But for those that may have grown a little fuzzy or some of our, we have a lot of younger listeners, could you review the times, what it was like in 69? You do an amazing job in the beginning of the book just setting the cultural ethos, as well as the narrative that we've all heard that this was Manson ordered this based on the Beatles and the Bible for Helter Skelter, mm-hmm. and put out there the narrative we've all heard in the tabloids and such, and that your book deconstructs and takes a new look at. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the late 60s, Richard, it was one of the most divisive times in this country's history. Probably nothing come close to it since the Civil War. But you had many factions going back and forth due to the Vietnam War, the emergence of the civil rights movements and other social movements like that. And there was quite a bit of rhetoric in the air, not just rhetoric, but reality of violence back and forth. Riots in the cities, shootouts between Black Panthers and police. You had the Weather Underground bombing government facilities and other things, ROTC centers on campuses and things like that. So it really was a time of intense conflict, almost a state of war existing between what I define as the forces of the young people at the time and the forces of the older people or the establishment. So it was ingrained in people that violence was could be an acceptable way of dealing with an issue.
Mm. And I know you're from Ohio.
Yes.
Yeah, you're from Ohio. I'm from Pennsylvania. And back in your home state, they had the whole Kent State shootings would be an example of that, of the quote-unquote establishment shooting the students.
Exactly. You had actually people dying in the streets, National Guardsmen shooting students on universities. I mean, there's nothing really today that compares to the mood of that time. Mm. And that wasn't the only incident where students were shot and killed and rioters and things like that. It seemed like there could be a war at any time.
Mm. Yeah, and the whole quote-unquote hippie culture and everything was a part, I guess, of when Charles Manson got out of prison, I think it was in 67, and the whole Summer of Love period is coming there, and he was up in Haight-Ashbury. How would you characterize, I guess, him and the circle that we now know that have become quite famous? I guess Bugliosi would say he was the leader, the guru, and your book talks about him being a leader and charismatic, but what would be the most accurate picture of him at that time for you?
Well, I'm not going to deny that he had some leadership capabilities with that group. He was older than most of the people, more experienced, more sure of himself. I mean, people would look at him and see someone who was confident in himself and want to emulate him. He was a person who could take care of problems for them, like finding them places to live and other things like that. So, and like I said, being older than them, it's natural for them to look up to him and give him some sort of leadership status, whether he wanted it or not. And it's my opinion that he didn't really, that a lot of this leadership role that he played was reluctant on his part. Manson himself, as far as being a hippie, was, as I said, older than most of the people at that time. And then you can see pictures of him with long hair and a beard and where he looks like a hippie, but he certainly didn't consider himself a hippie because he didn't grow up in that time. It wasn't the, you know, the years that formed him were the 40s and 50s, not the 60s. So the people around him maybe, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, one of the things you mentioned in your book was his early life I think you said something like it was the most important in understanding him was some of the early. I've heard, you know, the apocryphal stories. I'm not sure. I haven't vetted them to the degree you have, but like I've heard his mother was, they claim a prostitute or at one point gave him away for a case of beer. What do you know about his childhood?
Well, there are stories like that. You know, he did have a rough upcoming. He didn't really have a father figure in his life, and his mother went to prison when he was very young, so he was shunted around from relative to relative. His relationship with her was very sporadic, and I don't think I would exactly characterize her as a prostitute, but she wasn't a prude either. I think she had him when she was 14 or 15, so... we're not talking about an angel, but we're not. He says that she wasn't what he calls a flatback prostitute, but that she worked bars and would give her favors to men for money and occasionally roll them and things like that. But you have to understand a lot of the things that are given as influences of him are things like the Process Church and other groups like that. But just like anyone else, Manson was formed by the people he knew when he was a young boy and a man, young man, and the people around him, and the experiences he had. He went off to boys' schools and places like that when he was very young, so he was getting institutionalized. And these are the things that shaped his worldview, if you will, more than any Church of Satan or whatever the other influences that Bugliosi claims to have had on him.
Yeah, and that the whole Satan issue brings up, I think, how Bugliosi sold this narrative to the jury and to our popular culture that he's, been Satan incarnate and demonized. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of us that followed the case have wondered, about a more nuanced view of him. I guess for those that are a little rusty on it, and maybe you can help me out, but basically Bugliosi's narrative is that, that he had this cult and he was the guru and he told all these people to, he told all these folks to execute these Tate LaBianca murders, to start Helter Skelter. What was Bugliosi's story? That's pretty much it, but maybe you could flesh it out a little bit more.
Well, it is a complicated thing. Supposedly there were all these influences from the Beatles and the Bible, the Book of Revelations, and things that Manson and the people around him were supposed to have put together that would give them this apocalyptic vision of a race war that they would eventually win and thus rule the world, or at least the United States, one of those, take your pick from whoever's saying what at the time. But basically, the reason he had to come up with that fantastic motive, which is, perhaps the most fantastic motive ever put forth by a prosecuting attorney, is to show that Manson had the intent to commit these murders. Because without that critical element of intent, he couldn't get a conviction against Manson. There was no other evidence against Manson that he had any intent or desire that these murders happen, and it was only with the helter-skelter motive that he could demonstrate that intent. So that's why it was so important for him to come up with that motive, because otherwise he would have had nothing to say, no reason to say why Manson ordered these murders, because he had no personal benefit to be derived from them.
I remember even as a child thinking, George, that, how did this guy convict him when he wasn't present for the murders? I don't understand that part of it. He wasn't there. He didn't do it. And, of course, that's just a kid asking a question. But he had to really sell them that it was his charisma, his direction, his influence, which probably most people in our country would say is what happened. I mean, that's the conventional narrative. Now, in your book, you talk about some alternatives, and one being and if I get any of this wrong, just feel free to correct me, but Susan Atkins, Tex Watson, the people that did this, Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Krenwinkel, Krenwinkel or something like that?
Krenwinkel,
that they did this to try to free another friend. Was it Bobby Boussoulet from jail?
Yes, that's right.
And how would, I know it's hard sometimes to rationally explain what's irrational behavior, but how in their minds, what's that that second narrative, and how in their minds would doing these murders help Bobby?
Well, their theory was that if murders similar to the murder that Bobby Boussoulet was convicted of, which was the murder of Gary Hinman, they believed that if similar murders were committed, the police would believe that the true killer of Gary Hinman was still at large and thus free Bobby Boussoulet from that charge. Now, I'll have to say from the beginning, it was not a good plan. It wasn't well thought out. And I freely admit that in my book. But when you look at a crime like this, or any crime, there is a motive behind it. And if you remove the helter-skelter motive because it's fantastic, and you still have to find another motive. And my research in the case, this is the other motive. And I'm not saying it's brilliant, but that was the reasoning behind it. There were certain characteristics of the Hinman murder, stab wounds, writing on the wall in blood, that they were trying to replicate at the Polanski and LaBianca residences with the writing on the wall there, in a hope to make the police believe that the killers were still at large.
A few of the myths we've all heard, or at least the urban legends, maybe we could throw them out there and hear from you what you found out. One thing we hear a lot about, there's so many crazy things. We've heard Charles Manson audition for the Monkees, and that's apparently not true, right?
No, some of these things are pretty silly, but that one, I believe the Monkees went on the air in 1966, if I recall correctly, because I was 12 at the time. He wasn't released from prison until March of 1967, so it would have been impossible for him to audition for a TV show that premiered 6 or 8 months before he was released from prison. So that one's pretty easy to debunk.
And another part is the music part. And by the way, if you guys YouTubed or Googled Manson's some of his music, I teach guitar professionally and teach a course at Valley College, and I really enjoyed Game? Look at Your Game, Girl. And some of his songs, he was, I think, a good songwriter. And the Beach Boys, there's the music side of this. The standard thing a lot of the things have put forth was that he was hoping to get a breakthrough. I think he knew Dennis Wilson, was it? And some people put forward that Manson was behind this out of anger towards Doris Day's son, Terry Melcher, not giving them a break or a music thing, and Polanski and Sharon Tate happened to be in Terry Melcher's old house. What about that one?
Well, I think it's pretty, it would be a pretty extreme thing to do, to commit 5 brutal murders just to let somebody know that you're mad at them, when it might be easier just to make a phone call or something. that is one of the alternate motives. One of the prosecutors said that the message to Melcher was supposedly there, but for the grace of God, go you. But Melcher, since the murders happened in his old house, had many discussions with the owner of that house after the murders, and it never occurred to him that Manson was involved. Manson's name never came up in their discussions. So if he was supposed to be sending him a message, he didn't get it. So I think, you know, a lot of people think, gee, of course everybody would want to be a success in show business, so that appeals to the general public as a reasonable motive. But believe it or not, not everybody does want to be big in show business, and I think Manson fits in that latter category. I think he took a look at what was involved in it and rejected it pretty quickly.
And how about the drugs? Some of the people, I think Susan Atkins now is the first to pass in her 60s in prison. I think her and some of the others have said they did this not knowing what they were doing, that they were in a drug-induced state on acid. And you know, to what extent do you think drugs or any kind of mental illness or other things, because it seems like some of the folks doing time said this was a lapse, I can't believe I did this, and what role is that involved?
Well, I don't know about LSD, but I know that the two of the main participants in the crime, Susan Atkins and Charles Tex Watson, both say that they were using methamphetamine for quite some time before the murders. And I think if you do any research into methamphetamine or speed, you'll find out that it can produce homicidal feelings in people. It can make them act irrationally. It can actually, I believe, explain a lot of the aspects of these murders, the ferocity of the attacks, the fact that, as I said before, the plan wasn't that good. Speed is a good drug for when you do it, you think, gee, this is the most brilliant idea in the world. And then when you sober up, you go, God, how could I have ever thought that smart? It's ridiculous. So I think that the use of amphetamines by some of the people involved did play a role in it. I don't think there's much to the theory that people were brainwashed through the use of LSD or anything like that. But they're really, I think that the drug use by the people they call the family is pretty much overstated. They weren't drug-crazed all the time. They lived on Spahn's ranch. They had to do a lot of work there. There were a lot of things that they had to keep their heads together for. So recreationally, sure. Spiritually, religiously, sure. But I think if you want to look at a drug that would have contributed to these murders more than anyone else, I would have to say it was speed.
Okay. I know you've been asked this 10,000 times, but as you went to prison and talked extensively with Charles Manson, you know, what was your experience like? What was he like? By the way, the book is Goodbye Helter Skelter, and we're just scratching the surface, but I thought it was a very nuanced look at Manson, you know, the good, bad, and ugly, as they say. Tell us about your experience. You talked in the book about being a little nervous going into maximum security prison, and what was your experience like of him, you know, as a person?
Well, I have to say, like I say in the book, if I had to describe him in one word, the word would be prison, because he's just been institutionalized his whole life, and it's shaped his whole being. It shaped the way he looks at things, the way he does things, the way he reacts to things, and I mean, it's hard really in one word or sentence to describe someone that you've interacted with for 11 or 12 years. But I would just say prison, really. If that says it. I mean, I remember the first time that we had a contact visit, I knocked behind glass and he came out of the back room and walked over to me to shake hands, and I thought, this guy is just prison. That's what he is. And if you look at in the book, the way he reacts to things like dealing with the snitch or something like that, it's all based on his experience with prison and the things that he was taught in there by other men, many of whom were in the military, procedures, rules, things like that.
Yeah, he talked about that collective mind.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And I've heard him brag too, I think in the Charlie Rose interview, that there's no stitches on or snitches on my jacket, that his relationship to the other prisoners. Your book has a lot of his art, taking what he had, the colored socks, and making animals out of them, and drawing on postcards that he sent you. In the interviews, he seems to have a very abstract, non-conventional way of looking at things. Did you find him hard to follow, or was it easy for you to converse with him when you were doing your interviews?
Sometimes it's hard to he was hard to follow. They were really more conversations than interviews. I wasn't really I was relating to him as a friend, not somebody who was working on a book. And a lot of the material from the book is taken from tape-recorded telephone conversations, which have a lot of just personal stuff back and forth, but also a lot of material that is case that I could use with the book. But he could be hard to follow. On the other hand, when he wanted to be specific, he could be completely specific. A lot of what he says, it sounds like gibberish, is, again, coming from his experience in prison. And the terminology, the words he uses, there's a lot of things going on in prison that people outside just don't have any idea about. And he's reflecting a lot of that. But certainly sometimes he could be hard to understand. It could be frustrating trying to communicate with him. But he was also very reasonable, not out of control. I mean, not crazy at all. And certainly rational enough when he wanted to be. So
yeah,
I couldn't say
he
was just I couldn't just say he was a raving lunatic, because he's just not at all.
And you do say he was charismatic. He certainly has a strong charisma. Huh?
Oh, sure. Yep.
But you say kind of reasonable or rational when he wanted to be. Do you think sometimes when people have gone in to interview him, he performs or acts a little bit more out there because he's playing with them when they trigger him or push his buttons? Or do you think that he decides when he's going to be more reasonable with people? Because with you, I'm sure he trusted you more than Geraldo Rivera or people that come in with a very clear agenda.
Certainly, I think a lot of what he is doing for media interviews, I wouldn't say performing, but was for their benefit. Like, I think he says, that's what they expect. I think over the years he's seen his image as being, as he says, a hippie cult leader, mass murderer, and how would you play that card? Well, if that's what everybody thinks you are, how are you going to act? Are you going to be totally rational? Are you going to... It's basically kind of like giving the people what they want. So, and he's coming in, and people who are coming in to interview him expect that, because that's what they're selling. So that's what he would give them. But he would also drop intelligence on them, as he says. He says he'd give them a little bit of the crazy, and then when they're digesting that, he'd drop a little bit of intelligence on them. So I think that was one of the things that came through to me when I was watching interviews before I met him, was that there really was an intelligent mind working behind this on a real, maybe kind of a subtle level, but definitely there.
You quote at the end of your book a verse from the Bible. It was a theme verse of a film I just made on Clemente. Greater love has no man than this, that a man laid down his life for his friends. And let me see if I'm kind of explaining the context right. If not, let me know. Is that in the book you think this second narrative, that some of these folks, Tex Watts and Susan Atkins, did this not ordered by him, but to free Bobby Boussoulet, and Manson took his licks in terms of his sentencing, even though he was not there present at the murders, is that kind of collective prison mindset of we all hang together or hang separately. I mean, am I interpreting that right?
Yes, I think that if he had wanted to, you know, he's often been portrayed as this heartless person who was just using people and having them go out to commit murder for his goals and having no regard for them as people and not caring about whether they went to the gas chamber. When in reality, I think that if he'd really been self-serving, he could have separated his case from theirs and gotten a lighter sentence. But instead, he stuck with them to the possibility of going to the gas chamber, which he originally was sentenced to do. So, to me, that shows a lot of love. And that's the thing that, to me, is the most admirable quality of him, is his loyalty to his friends. I mean, he's still loyal to them, even after 45 years when everybody practically has denounced him and said, put him down. I mean, he still speaks well of those people and what they were trying to do.
Wow. Well, the time is just ripping on by here. We have a few minutes left, so we're going to just take a super quick program identification break. And I want to invite everyone to email or call in a question if they like to. RichardRossiLive@gmail.com, or you can call the number on the screen, 347-637-2379. And we'll be right back with George and some wrap-up and some hopefully some thoughtful questions on this.
I know what you're thinking. Since the phone lines are all busy, should I or shouldn't I keep calling? Well, if I were you, I'd keep trying. Go ahead and make your day.
Welcome back. We're here with George Stimson. Our first questions come in here through our email here. Was Manson much of a reader? This particular person, thought that he seemed, you know, in many cases of more intelligence than the people that went in to interview him, and seemed quite bright, even though he doesn't have, I don't think, he doesn't have higher education. Did he finish high school?
No, I don't think he went beyond the third grade, really.
Wow. So is he much of a reader?
As far as being a reader, I can't see him sitting down and devouring books. On the other hand, he's picked up a lot of knowledge in his years, and he's very, I would say he's educated, but not formally so. He can be very, speak knowledgeably on many, many different subjects and topics. So not formally educated, but he's got a lot of education.
Okay, and this question from Barbie in Virginia, how do we, I guess, you know, this comes down to the whole Rashomon film where there's different stories of the same event, but she asks, how do we know, or how do we decide whether Manson's, minimizing his, I have a little problem some of the spelling on this, minimizing his influence. I think what she's asking is, we have a couple narratives. Bugliosi, he ordered this. The second narrative to get Bobby out was that some of these people did this on their own, though they were under his influence. How did you assess to what degree Manson's influence was in this whole thing?
Well, I had to look at the whole thing and see and take the both narratives and see which one jived better with the known reality, the circumstances of the case, the relationships of the people involved, the certain events that happened, the criminal activity that happened before the murders and how it led up to them. And I think when you consider those two scenarios, the helter-skelter motive or the get brother out of jail motive, makes a lot more sense, and it's just a lot more believable. And to me, that makes it a lot more true. I mean, you just evaluate two different stories, and whichever one seems more credible is the one you go with. That's the way I look at it.
One last question here from Andre in Seattle. Manson became an archetype for Satan. He mentions a legend that he leaped supernaturally, you know, at the judge in a way that was not physically possible, all those kind of, urban stories. Do you think that made it difficult for people to take a realistic look?
Well, when you look at all the media coverage of the trial in Manson, I mean, it's been piled on him so deeply, it would be hard for anybody to wade through it all and see it. I mean, his leap at the judge, it couldn't have been impossible because he did it. But it's just another one of those stories. I think a lot of the things that are put forth as being true might be based on the truth, but they've been exaggerated just a little bit to make them a little more offbeat or sinister. So. Mm.
Well,
you
I can't believe
go
it.
Through. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, I can't believe how quickly our time's gone. Your book is so exhaustive, and we've just scratched the surface. I mean, there's so much
mm-hmm.
interesting stuff in here about the trial and the whole controversy over Manson defending himself. There's just so much stuff we didn't even get to.
Mm-hmm.
But we can get this book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it's goodbyehelterskelter.com, right? George.
Right, and I hope the book just makes people think. That's all I'm trying to get people to do is think.
Uh-huh. I imagine this has been tough for you because we're going a few seconds over time, so I'm asking
mm-hmm.
some grace
mm-hmm.
from Blog Talk Radio. But I mm-hmm. think when there's a popular first impression of a media case like an OJ case or a Manson
mm-hmm.
case, and it's the narrative we all hear first in the mass media, it is really hard for people to consider another viewpoint. I mean, that's something you're fighting against, number one. But number two, the fact that you're not saying he's Satan incarnate, that he's a human being. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, people hate this man and have made certain figures like him the
mm-hmm.
totality of evil in their mind. So
mm-hmm.
is that tough for you even to take a nuanced look at this in terms of what comes back to you?
Well, you know, I think people, hate is a natural emotion for, you know, much as we would rather not have it be, and I think that people need somebody that it's safe to hate. So I think Charles Manson is one of those people, Hitler's another, perhaps the Ayatollah Khomeini's another. I mean, you can find these characters in history that it's okay to dislike. So I think if people want an outlet for their hostility, these people that they're allowed to hate come in handy. But, you know, you kind of have to look around behind that or beyond it, I think, and suspend it. It's an easy way out. I mean, like I say, it's not always easy to try to understand someone.
Yeah. Well, you certainly did that with a really, open mind. And you've done a lot of research and documentation, and I really am grateful you came on today. We've just scratched
okay,
the surface, and for any of you
mm-hmm.
listening that have an interest to go further, you'll find it a riveting read. I sure did. Goodbye, Helter Skelter by George Stimson. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, George.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Okay. And thank you to all of you for listening. Tomorrow at 2:30 p.m. we're having a show about animation. Andrew Ramos, who Disney animator, did Mickey Mouse and Aladdin, and also Ninja Turtles, a lot of the great cartoons. We'll be talking about art and animation. And George's book has, by the way, a lot of interesting photographs of art as well, created by Charles Manson in prison. That was really quite astounding to see these color photographs of all of this in the book. Thank you, all of you, for listening. Go with God and be blessed, and thank you for your support of the show. You can click follow if you haven't done that already, and we'll be back on air tomorrow. Goodbye from Richard Rossi Live.